from WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Bewildering stories of espionage tumbling out of Guantanamo Bay. The news this week, a Muslim U.S. Army chaplain arrested for carrying sensitive documents off the naval base. Now we learn that an Air Force interpreter of Syrian descent faces serious charges, including spying for the Syrian government, that could bring him the death penalty. And word today that at least two more members of the U.S. military are now under scrutiny and more arrests may come. Guantanamo is supposed to be America's super terrorist lockup, where 680 prisoners, Al-Qaeda and Taliban from 40 countries, are being held. Details remain murky, but already they trace the outline of scandal. Both the chaplain and the interpreter talked extensively to Guantanamo prisoners and may have known each other. The military is shaken up and is reportedly launching a broader investigation tonight on Point. Mystery, security, and spy charges, fault lines in America's most high-security terrorist prison. On Tuesday, word leaked out that Muslim Army Chaplain Yusuf Yi was detained September 10th. Yesterday, word that senior airman Ahmed Al-Halabi was detained July 23rd. Today, the Pentagon said a third serviceman is being investigated. And CNN is reporting there is a fourth under scrutiny. To follow the broadening investigation, I turned to John Mintz, who writes about homeland security and terrorism for The Washington Post. I asked him what is going on at Guantanamo.
It is a mystery. It's a very disturbing mystery. Two members of the armed forces at Guantanamo Bay, the most secure penal colony for alleged terrorists in the United States government, are under severe suspicion of espionage and turning against the United States, essentially. It should be pointed out that there's no proof that they are guilty of anything, but there are some disturbing allegations about them.
Earlier this week, we first heard about the Army Muslim chaplain, Captain James Yi, who had been detained September 10th, and now word that earlier this summer, an Air Force translator, a native of Syria who immigrated to the U.S. as a teenager, Ahmad Halabi, 24 years old, has also been detained. What can you tell us about this Air Force translator?
This young man, who is 24 years old, came to the United States to live in the Detroit area about 10 years ago when he was a teenager. His father was a master chef in Damascus, Syria. He went to high school. He wasn't that interested in academics. He then joined the Air Force about 4 years ago, and he worked as a supply clerk. And then when the U.S. military opened up Guantanamo Bay, they needed Arabic translators, and they sent for Mr. Al-Halabi, and he's been there for about 9 months. He worked with interrogators who were questioning the alleged Al-Qaeda members there, and now it emerges that he was arrested on July 23rd of this year, and the Air Force authorities say that he was arrested with a lot of documents, classified documents, that he should not have had as a translator. These documents include letters written by some of the prisoners that had not been cleared for release, apparently. He also had downloaded 180 letters sent by various of the detainees to their families. Unclear whether those letters actually were ever cleared for release to the families. He also had maps of the Guantanamo Bay facilities. He had one or two intelligence documents, unclear even what they are, and various classified listings of the prisoners and their numbers and the numbers of their cells, things that you wouldn't expect that a linguist there would be walking around with. And ultimately, the Air Force authorities are saying that he was trying to get this material in the hands of representatives of Syria. It's unclear. At one point, they refer to the Syrian embassy, other point to Syrian representatives, and other points about people from Syria.
Unlike Chaplain He, against whom we're told no charges have yet been brought, there's quite an array of charges that are already standing against Ahmad Halabi.
Yes, this is preliminarily now, but he's been hit with about 30 charges, including espionage, lying to investigators, even financial frauds, apparently, earlier in his life. He could receive the death penalty for these. Incidentally, Captain Yi, the chaplain, he apparently has been charged in some fashion. It is being kept a secret what the charges are, But under military law, in order to detain him, experts tell me that he must have been charged at least enough to persuade a military magistrate to keep him in the slammer, which is where he is.
Now, both of these military officers would have had extended, intimate contact with prisoners at Guantanamo, and they were active there at the same time. Do we know whether or not they had contact between them, that is, Yi and Halabi?
People at Guantanamo Bay believe that these two gentlemen knew each other at least glancingly, but nobody knows if they knew each other more than that. But that is one of the areas that's under intense investigation. Incidentally, Captain Yi, the chaplain, has a connection to Syria also. He went to West Point and was in the military in the early 90s. He served in Saudi Arabia. Then he converted to Islam, quit the military, and moved to Syria in the mid-90s, lived there for 4 years, studying Islamic affairs and Arabic before returning to the United States and becoming an imam in the U.S. military.
You've spoken with the translator's family. How did they explain his continuing interaction with Syrian authorities, and what did they tell you about him? Did these charges make sense to them?
The family thinks that this is all a misunderstanding, in fact, based on love. The young Air Force linguist has a fiance in Syria. He has been back to Syria to see her at least once in the past year. They plan to be married. And with each one of those trips, Al-Halabi has had dealings with the Syrian embassy in Washington. And he also was arranging for his fiance, a young Syrian woman, to come here to live in the United States when they were married. And the family is saying that the U.S. investigators are confusing his contacts with the Syrian embassy with something sinister.
His military-assigned attorney says that Airman Al-Halabi is not a spy and is not a terrorist. Is there an innocent explanation that can be imagined for carrying these letters and these materials out of Guantanamo?
It would be extremely ill-advised for people in this war on terrorism to be mucking about and downloading off of secure government computers, as Al-Halabi apparently did. Now, he could have done that without being a spy, so the government may have a case where they've got a young man who did something stupid and was walking around with documents he shouldn't have, and at the same time, he's dealing with the Syrian government, which is something that may cast some suspicion on himself. And these are two facts that when you put them together, it looks like it's a huge, terrible scandal, and maybe there's an innocent explanation. Maybe, in fact, he's a spy, and maybe he was downloading these documents for Syrian officials or somebody else in Syria.
We understand there's an ongoing investigation that may go beyond these two men. You write that U.S. authorities are really shaken by the possibility that Guantanamo Bay may have been compromised by American military personnel.
They certainly are shaken. There are apparently even other investigations of other members of the armed forces. Specifics of these have not emerged, but there may be other arrests. U.S. Military officials and intelligence officials are launching larger investigations into the chaplains in the military and the security at Guantanamo Bay, and they are not sure where this is going to end.
Senator Charles Schumer of New York and others in Congress have been very critical this week of the vetting of Muslim chaplains, and yet the military has had it as a point of pride to have Muslim chaplains.
The military people are rightfully proud of the fact that there are representatives of all major religions ministering to members of the U.S. armed forces all over the world. Indeed, there are between 12 and 15 Islamic chaplains in the U.S. military. They have all been sponsored or vetted by two or three institutes in the United States. And each of these institutes have had associations with Muslim figures or other organizations that are under investigation for ties to terrorism. So Senator Chuck Schumer is pointing out that each of these institutes that trains Muslim chaplains have had these associations, and he thinks that this warrants even heavier investigations. I think those investigations are underway.
John Mintz, thanks very much for joining us.
You're welcome.
John Mintz covers terrorism and homeland security for The Washington Post. He spoke with me from Washington, D.C. Can you believe what you're hearing from Guantanamo Bay? What do you make of it? And does it look like high espionage or sympathy run amok? Can you imagine Al-Qaeda reaching into the heart of Guantanamo? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me right now from Durham, North Carolina, is Scott Silliman. He is a professor at Duke University Law School and executive director of Duke's Center on Law, Ethics, and National Security. He served as a Judge Advocate General, or JAG, lawyer for the Air Force for 25 years. Good evening and welcome, Professor Silliman.
Good evening, Tom. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Thanks for joining us. Also joining us from New York is Ted Conover. He's a writer for the New York Times Magazine and author of In the Land of Guantanamo in the magazine this summer. He's also author of New Jack, Guarding Sing Sing and Coyotes, A Journey Through the Secret World of America's Illegal Aliens. Good evening and thanks for joining us, Ted Conover.
Thank you, Tom.
Scott Silliman, to you first. You're very familiar with the military justice system. How do you read what's going on here?
Well, first of all, Tom, I think it needs to be said that we probably would not even know about this massive investigation and these two arrests had it not been for the attorneys for Halabi, who, when he went through what's called an Article 32 investigation, which is a formal investigation of the charges made against him.
Kind of like a grand jury.
Exactly. It's the equivalent of a grand jury,
yes,
Tom.
Okay.
Very similar. And that his attorneys basically moved before the judge that be made public rather than being classified and held private. And the Air Force's highest military court agreed and directed that it be made public. Once that was done, of course, it was recognized that there was an individual who was being processed for charges that could lead to a court-martial and, in his case, possible death. And then I think the ultimate public affairs view was we need to talk a little bit about this, especially about Halabi and, of course, Yi. So this probably would have gone on for a little longer to allow the military, both the Army and the Air Force, to investigate what's going on down there, as John Mintz suggested they are doing, under a cloak of secrecy. But now it's out and we're all trying to figure out what's going on.
A lot of smoke pouring out here. Does it suggest to you, from your familiarity, that there is, in fact, as you say, a massive investigation?
I think there is, Tom, and I think the gravity of the charges that have been preferred against Halabi indicated. Again, John Mintz indicated in his lead-in story here, you're talking about aiding the enemy under the Uniform Code of Military Justice. You're talking about espionage, both under the Uniform Code of Military Justice, under the federal statute. These are extremely grave offenses, and particularly with regard to the communication of classified information, possibly to a Syrian agent or a Syrian embassy. That constitutes a tremendous possible compromise of the security procedures at Guantanamo Bay, which, as your listeners know, is the epitome of security as far as the United States is concerned, and now it apparently has been compromised.
In the war on terror, or so we thought. Ted Conover, you spent a good deal of time at Guantanamo. There's an aura of mystery around this that's just hard to get past. How do you read this? I mean, you talked with all kinds of servicemen who weren't real happy down there. It's a stressful place. Does this smell like espionage to you or like some kind of compassion run amok?
I'm no expert in these matters. I do understand prisons a little bit from having worked in one, and I did interview Yusuf Yi for more than half an hour when I was down there. I was particularly interested in him because he, as well as Al-Halabi, who I never met.
And then, Yusuf Yi is, of course, the Muslim army chaplain.
That's
who was
right.
Also detained.
West Point graduate who moved to Syria, converted to Islam, and then became a Muslim chaplain. I was interested in speaking to him just because he works right at this sort of perilous margin between us and them, if you will. He is the representative of the U.S. military, which in the eyes of a lot of the people he is ordered to minister to, is the enemy. And I asked him, does that make the job hard? And it was a very frustrating interview because he acted as though I hadn't asked that question twice.
He really couldn't answer. Ted Conover, hold the thought. We're going to come back and look closely here. Scott Silliman, we're talking tonight about the sudden mess of spy charges at Guantanamo. Can you believe what you're hearing from Guantanamo? What do you make of it? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the sudden mess of spy charges at Guantanamo and what's going on with terror suspects and U.S. soldiers at the military's most secure prisoner facility. You can join the conversation. Does this look to you like high espionage or like sympathy run amok? Can you imagine Syria or al-Qaeda being able to reach right into Guantanamo? Or is something else entirely going on here? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. My guests from Durham, North Carolina, Scott Silliman, a former JAG lawyer in the U.S. Air Force for 25 years, now a professor at Duke University Law School. And from New York, Ted Conover, a writer for the New York Times Magazine who has spent time at Guantanamo. Ted, I'm sorry we had to interrupt you, but you were saying you sat with Army chaplain, Muslim chaplain, Yusuf Yee, originally James, changed his name when he converted, and asked him what and that he had to ignore?
I was asking him if it made his job hard, if it made it hard to communicate with the detainees, that the fact he was a Muslim with the U.S. military, that is, these guys see the military as the enemy, and here you work for the military, does that make it hard for you to talk to them, to minister to them? And he didn't want to go there. To the extent that he would not even sort of acknowledge the question, he ignored me and talked about other things. And I finally just brought it up and said, "Well, have you been asked this too many times? Is that the problem?" Mm-hmm. And he just said, "It's the job isn't always easy, but I do everything in my power to satisfy my commanding officers and do my job properly."
Let me ask you, Ted, there are a lot of facts to come out here, and we don't have them at this point. But on the other hand, you've written a lot about Guantanamo. You've written about how U.S. soldiers who had no kind of Middle Eastern background or Islamic affiliation found it onerous psychologically to work there, to see the conditions of the prisoners day after day. You quoted a Staff Sergeant Laura Frost from Michigan saying that she said, "I had felt very heavy in my heart for what was going on there. You know, there's things that have happened that I'm glad I wasn't there to see." This is after she got out. Can you imagine any soldier, or particularly with a Middle Eastern background, an Islamic soldier, just breaking and not being able to take the witnessing of the circumstances of prisoners there?
Well, certainly I can. And prison work is, in its very nature, very difficult. And the people who are sent down there to do it are not in the main professional jailers. They're mostly reservists who've done other things in life. And I think it's a very hard job. I did notice from the months I spent working in Sing Sing that often, corrections officers or people who run a prison, they tend to gravitate toward one of two poles. They either consider the prisoners sort of animals and monsters who deserve what they've got and no favor from us. There's a really hard, hard-ass approach. And then there are those who are a little bit more willing to consider the prisoners people who went astray. They did something wrong. They're paying for it. Could have been me, perhaps, if I weren't, if I hadn't dodged a couple bullets along the way. And I would just think that particularly if you were a chaplain or a translator and you had daily contact with these men who are of your religion, who are devoutly of your religion, and remember Chaplain Yee converted to Islam, one can imagine he himself is quite devout. The conditions there are I would say, extraordinarily harsh. It's like a supermax prison, but worse in terms of the space they get, the exercise they get, and that one great intangible which lets so many prisoners carry on, the knowing how long they're in for and counting the days. Well, in Guantanamo, they all sort of seem to think they're never going to be let out. There's no adjudication that's begun in any meaningful way. And I think there's a great deal of hopelessness. I know that Laura Frost, who I quoted, said that a lot of prisoners writing home would ask her help putting them in English. And this may explain some of the letters that Mr. Al-Halabi was carrying. Mm-hmm. If you write a letter in English, if you write it home in English, it gets out a lot faster than if you write it in your native tongue and it has to get translated by the intelligence officers there. They translate everything that goes in or out. And so when I heard that he was carrying all those letters, I thought, oh, well, maybe it's like the baklava that he is charged with bringing them, you know, you suppose as a favor. He just said, well, look, I know it takes 3 months to get these out. I'll carry these for you.
You just have to wonder, Scott Silliman, how does it look to you? Small kindnesses here, getting letters out to family, bringing baklava in, or serious espionage?
Well, let me pick up, Tom, with something that Ted brought up about the types of individuals that are down at Guantanamo Bay on behalf of our military, Army, and Air Force. You've got a professional core of security personnel, active duty security personnel, who are used to dealing in very stringent conditions. But then on the other hand, as we found out with Al-Halabi and with Chaplain Yi, you're bringing in groups of individuals for specific needs who are not trained in security duties. And down at Guantanamo Bay, as I'm sure Ted found out, it's a very difficult situation even for the military personnel. There's a General Order Number 2 that imposes severe restrictions on all the military personnel down there that unless they're used to that type of extremely disciplined environment, they're going to have difficulty operating within it and let alone the conditions that they're seeing among the detainees. So,
Ted reports even signs all over the place for U.S. soldiers helping them cope with depression, saying this is really rough.
I think we could expect that, just as you expect depression and anxiety in folks in a war environment. Matter of fact, I think you can almost equate it, Tom, with a wartime environment. Now, interestingly, I think you can distinguish between Yi and Al-Halabi, though. Yi came out of West Point, a very disciplined military academy, and then went to Syria for 4 years where he was converted to Islam and then came back into the Army.
A pretty wild story in itself. I mean, what an unusual path for a military career.
It really is. And, of course, then he went back into the Army as a Muslim chaplain, and I think there are only 10 of them in the Army. But what's fascinating to me is that with individuals like Yi and with Al-Halabi who were brought in for a particular specific purpose, the vetting process, the security clearance process, the investigation, knowing full well that they would be subject to pressures, something failed somewhere. And I think that's what's going on down there right now, is to look at these other folks to see, are there others perhaps who might be in that same position?
I mean, when you look at the story of Ahmed Al-Halabi, 24 years old, we just heard from John Mintz, didn't do well in school, joined the military, his family speaking up in the last week and saying, this guy loves America, but here he is, a supply clerk in the Air Force, and suddenly because he speaks Arabic, he's thrown into the middle of terrorist interrogations where he's the guy who's the go-between. If they're delivering some menacing message to the terror suspect, he's the guy who has to deliver it. I mean, that sounds, Scott Silliman, like a very heavy burden for a 24-year-old pulled out of a supply room to bear.
I think you're exactly right, Tom. Remember that we've got professional interrogators down there. But there needs to be that translator, that bridge. And he's right there. He's got face-to-face contact with the detainees, just like Captain Chaplain Yi did. So they are confronting the detainees in a way that even some of the peripheral guards are not. But that's the issue that I think the military is trying to come to grips with right now, is are we sure that all the folks we put down there for a temporary time are sufficiently equipped psychologically and with experience to deal with the situation and yet maintain the security that's absolutely required at Guantanamo Bay.
What a picture. Al-Halabi was named Airman of the Year at the base. His attorney said yesterday, or today, one really wonders what's going on. Ted Conover, I get this feeling, on the one hand, this could be espionage. And in that case, what an incredible story. If Syria or Al-Qaeda could engineer espionage that went right into the interrogation rooms at Guantanamo, it's incredible. On the other hand, you see people saying, well, what if this is just a human response to these very harsh conditions that you describe? But in both cases of these arrests, this is not just anybody. These are both Muslims in the U.S. military who were sort of pulled together in an all-points bulletin to help deal with this big challenge in Guantanamo. The military has prided itself on its diversity. Is it now going to find itself up against some kind of having to deal with its own paranoia or the possibility of real espionage? I mean, it looks like an impossibly difficult situation.
It does, and I hope it doesn't have a real negative backlash in terms of the military embracing or including Islam. because that would be a huge step backwards, I think. And the other thing I was thinking, I heard what Senator Schumer said today, and I've got to tell you, even after working at a maximum security prison like Sing Sing, when I had been at Guantanamo for a while, I thought, well, now this is real security. I mean,
impenetrable.
It is so locked down. It is so impenetrable. And when I heard Schumer saying how dire this was, I thought, well, even if they did find out who was in which cell, who was housed next to whom, what good would it ever do Syria? What good would it ever do anybody to know that kind of thing?
I mean, unless Osama bin Laden has got a motorboat and is planning to pull up and spring the crew.
If he pulls up in a motorboat, there's a dozen of our motorboats who are going to go blast him out of the water. That place is protected by water. It's protected by land with these constant patrols, Humvees. I think they're called 50-millimeter guns everywhere. I came to the camp several times in a van with high-ranking officers who were escorting me. And I think three of those times, everyone was forced to get out, and they searched the van inside and out, underneath. You know, these people know each other, but they act like they don't. The security is so tight there that I've got to say, I don't know what kind of breach would truly endanger our operation there.
On the other hand, we could be staring right at it. I mean, the airman Halaby was right in the interrogation room. You can imagine all kinds of scenarios, and they can go in such opposite directions. It really is mystifying. I want to begin to bring our callers in here. Scott Silliman, Ted Conover, stand by. David's calling from Hamilton, Massachusetts. Hi, David. You're on the air.
Yes, hi. This is a slight digression, but I sort of feel that this is a very concerning tip of the iceberg in terms of our evaluation of the way Muslim Americans are coming together on the war on terrorism. There was a grenade attack on our own troops by the Muslim soldier.
This was a black Muslim on the eve of the invasion of Iraq. Okay.
There are these two incidences. And interestingly, there was an article in the New York Times a while back about the role of Islamic clerics in other prison systems preaching hatred and things that weren't really, you know, doctrinal. There's a deafening silence in the Muslim community about the various acts of Islamic terrorism around the world.
Well, I don't know if it's completely deafening, David, but are you saying that, I mean, President Bush has, and the military have taken it as a point of pride that the United States government and military include many Muslim members and welcome them there? Are you this quick to say this group cannot be trusted? These are long-term residents of the United States in many cases.
Well, you know, it's always dangerous, but I think we have to reassess the situation. I think there's more to it than just giving everybody a blanket free ride. I think there truly has been a real silence for all our attempts to fight terrorism that's been based by Islam. I think there's going to be more of these things.
David, we've got the concern, but exactly how to process it, what a complicated issue. Thanks for your call. I want to welcome into our conversation Milt Bearden. He joins us tonight from Reston, Virginia. He's a 30-year veteran of the CIA, co-author of The Main Enemy, the inside story of the CIA's final showdown with the KGB. Good evening and welcome back to On Point, Milt Bearden.
Good to be with you.
Milt Bearden, look at this with us from an intelligence angle for a moment. If indeed, and who knows at this point, but if indeed these guys have been carrying messages and maps and interrogation room exchanges out of Guantanamo, even unto Syria, who knows where, do we have a major intelligence breach here, or does this look like sort of patty cake bringing baklava to the prisoners stuff to you?
I think that that issue is perhaps masking a much larger issue that's going on. I mean, we're seeing something now that one of your earlier callers was talking about that is starting to widen these fault lines between Muslim Americans and the rest of the United States. And this is what the story is going to be about, is the Islamic side of this thing. And we've got, what, 5 million, 6 million, 7 million, I'm not sure, Muslims in this in America, and we need their help. I mean, we're occupying a country in the Middle East right now where probably you can count on one or two hands blonde-haired, blue-eyed Americans that speak Arabic and speak it well enough to know what's going on around them. And to suggest that we have to revet these people is to say we're going to shut down an important part of this thing. I'm concerned when I see so much posturing in Washington over this as a major security breach. It's a huge issue, but I don't know how much, I can't see the major security side of this thing if Osama bin Laden's going to get a speedboat and do some sort of a John Woo scenario and attack one.
Right. So, but if it doesn't look like a security breach to you, then are you saying the issue of vetting U.S. personnel, U.S. Arab Americans, Muslim personnel, are you saying that that's going to be a necessity or that that is going to raise an unnecessary paranoia?
Well, I think we're going to have the paranoia. Oh, we've already got it with us now, is that we're a little paranoid about all of a sudden, these are Muslims. Some are suggesting that they slipped through the screening process and were bad already. I would submit that we'll probably learn that their sympathies began to develop after they got into the work they were doing. And this is an issue. We're going to end up where the huge issue is a social one within this country. These guys that are under being detained right now, these mm-hmm. two, and the third one that somebody's looking at in the Navy, are not like anybody that's been hauled in for espionage.
How so?
In the last 15 years.
Well, in what respect?
In the respect that when you look at Aldrich Ames or Edward Lee Howard, who escaped before he was arrested, or Robert Hansen or James Nicholson, CIA and FBI officers that were spying for the Soviets, the seven deadly sins were in there. These guys were either driven by greed or revenge or some strange demons, as in the case of Robert Hansen. The people we have now detained on this Guantanamo business are certainly driven by either ideology or religion or something else. And we haven't seen that in American espionage cases since the 1930s.
Or maybe just simple fellow feelings. Scott Silliman.
Well, that's what I'm saying, yes.
Well, Scott Silliman, we just got a few seconds before the break, but can you see the U.S. military dealing effectively with this? It's a point of pride in the military that they encompass diversity.
Well, I think you're exactly correct, Tom. But following up on what Milt was just saying, I think these two individuals are very much unlike the others because these individuals were not working in the intelligence community. They weren't working with the tools and the information that they then turned over to another country. These individuals were brought into the environment not because they asked for it, because they were sent there.
But as Milt Bearden says, the U.S. military is going to be depending and does depend right now on people like this. Scott Silliman, Ted Conover, Milt Bearden, please stand by. We're talking tonight about the sudden mess of spy charges at Guantanamo. Can you imagine a Muslim chaplain and a young Arab-American interpreter breaking the rules out of compassion for beleaguered prisoners? And what could Syria gain by snooping at Guantanamo? You can join us, 1-800-423-8255. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the sudden mess of spy charges at Guantanamo and what's going on with terror suspects and U.S. soldiers at the U.S. military's most secure prisoner facility. My guests tonight, Milt Bearden, a 30-year veteran of the CIA, Scott Silliman, professor at Duke University Law School and 25-year JAG lawyer for the Air Force, and writer for the New York Times Magazine, Ted Conover, who spent a lot of time in Guantanamo just a few months ago. You can join this conversation as well. What a picture here. If the war on terror distills into a clash of civilizations, can the U.S. military keep its diverse parts, its Muslims, in the fold? And how could this happen? What about vetting? Who's minding the store? Is this a crackdown on security breaches or on sympathetic humans or both? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Steve is calling from Somerville, Massachusetts. Hi, Steve. You're on the air.
Hi. I just wanted to suggest one, I think, quite likely possibility you're overlooking. The reason that these people had this information was because they were trying to be whistleblowers.
Whistleblowers on what, Steve?
Whistleblowers on the concentration camp, let's face it, that we're running down there. I think it's ironic that the only charges that seem to have been filed out of Guantanamo were not against the Afghanis or the Al-Qaeda, it's only against American service personnel who were probably people of good conscience who, like so many others that your previous guest commented on, sounded reprehensible.
I don't think we're overlooking it entirely, but we're just trying to deal with the complexity of it. Steve, even if that were true, can you see how that might turn into something that qualified as espionage? Or you're saying these are just Americans, albeit Muslims, who are standing up and saying that what's going on down here is wrong?
Well, I don't think you can stand up and say what's going on, or the military is going to crack down on you as it has on these individuals and drumming up charges, trying to make every casual act into some kind of court-martialable offense with death penalty hanging over their head. I think they're going to do everything in their part to keep as much silence enforced on our military personnel down there as they can.
Steve, thanks for the call, and let us pick it up. Ted Conover, you've called it the new American gulag. Can you imagine this as a kind of clampdown message from the U.S. military that no matter what you think of what's going on down there, soldier, you will not talk about it?
Oh, sure. I think that message is one the military is very eager to reinforce. To pick up on a fascinating suggestion you said earlier, what would Syria have to gain? It suddenly dawned on me that the lieutenant colonel down there who ran the press operation said that some of the detainees are afraid of what awaits them when they go home, the suggestion being if they have cooperated with Americans, if they have revealed secrets, there are some people who are going to be very upset about that. And one could imagine that as an intelligence aim of a foreign government.
To know who's saying what. And, of course, in the case of Airman Al-Halabi, he would have been in the room.
Oh, the interpreters will know everything. I mean, they'll know more than the U.S. intelligence people because of the nuance that they understand. And, they're the ones who are right there on the ground floor. So I asked if I could speak with some of the interpreters when I was there, they said no, they know too much.
Absolutely no talking to the interpreters, and yet the U.S. military and the terror suspects are talking through the interpreters. Mort's calling from Truro, Massachusetts. Hi, Mort, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi, it's Mort Dean calling. How are you? It's
very well.
Show. I think one answer to what the Syrians might have to gain, if they have to gain anything, is that, as Milt knows and others know, countries sell or trade information all the time for information that will provide them with gains. And secondly, I think one thing we're missing, and that's the potential of having an interpreter who is perhaps spying for another country in on interrogation. It allows that interpreter to rephrase the questions that are being put in English so that the person being interviewed will not answer in any way that might provide information to the Americans. And also, the interpreter who speaks the foreign language can also interpret the answers any way he sees fit, therefore provide the Americans with erroneous information.
Obviously could, and yet it seems like it could be a big leap as well to assume that a 24-year-old, Arab-American airman is suddenly a diabolically clever interpreter, not only manipulating the conversation but passing it on to Damascus, which, by the way, denied, of course, any involvement in this today. But Milt Bearden, let me put Mort Dean's question to you. Does it sound credible to you that this could be, in effect, a kind of Syrian or Al-Qaeda mole right in the heart of Guantanamo?
Well, you can't rule that out. I don't know that it'll play out that way, but it's one of the things that one has to consider in this thing. It's going to run the gamut from these guys just having some sort of humanitarian sympathy all the way to somebody that's hard over and working for another intelligence service. I don't think we're going to see it all the way down that line. I think we're going to see something else that is going to cause more debate. I mean, it's not as if Guantanamo wasn't something we talked about already, or hadn't talked about already. I mean, there, a lot of people in the world are pretty spun up over this whole issue.
Well, even our own Secretary of State sent a pretty stiff letter to Donald Rumsfeld back in the spring, complaining about the conditions at Guantanamo.
Yeah, so you've got all of these possibilities. My sense on Captain Yi would be that you're going to find that there's not some evil intelligence issue in the background. You're going to find some things that that probably lead more to the Muslim humanitarian side of it. But what I'm thinking more about now is what effect is this going to have on the small cadre of Muslims enlisted in officer personnel in the U.S. military.
It's got to be chilling.
I can tell you, when James Jesus Angleton at CIA started looking for an ethnic Russian whose name might begin with K, it was murder and mayhem and just awful, sick thing going around.
The suspicion.
And basically, the moles turned out to be, everybody born in, Lawrence, Kansas or something.
Scott Silliman, I hear you in the background there.
Yeah, I wanted to impose a note of caution here. When we're talking about either Yi or Halabi, and we're suggesting that they were under such emotional, psychological pressure that they might have broken, or we're even possibly suggesting that Halabi might have been co-opted by the Syrians, this is all speculation, and we really don't know what the motives are, and of course that's what the investigation's about. But we can't lose sight of the fact that whether we agree with the conditions in Guantanamo Bay or not, and I would remind your listeners that the International Committee of the Red Cross and many representatives of nations throughout the world have been down there and have been satisfied with the humane treatments that has been given to them.
We understand those visits, and yet Ted Conover has reported in some detail about the vast gap between what's there and, let's say, Geneva Convention expectations.
Well, I would disagree with him. I would disagree with Ted on that, and I've studied the Geneva Conventions and the application down there, and I've studied the court decisions on this. But whether we emotionally agree with the fact that that's a tough environment, and it is a tough environment, we've got to remember, Tom, that we've got 680 very dangerous people down there, and that it must be a more intensive security environment than Sing Sing. So I think we need to keep this in balance.
Absolutely.
And the last thing I think I want to caution us about is, going back to David's comment about perhaps this represents an uprising of the Muslims in this country, we saw that same thing start to be voiced after September 11th with regard to Arabs. And I think we really need to be very, very cautious to make sure that we're dealing with individuals here, and we're dealing with two individuals and possibly more. But these individuals, for whatever reason, whatever their motive of, in this, might have committed offenses, and that's what the appearance is. But I don't think we should automatically rush to a judgment against groups or ethnic groups or religious groups at this point.
Right. Well, that's exactly the span of possibilities, and there can be no judgment here, but the questions that are raised are so intriguing that we're looking at them. Chuck's calling from North Andover, Massachusetts. Hi, Chuck. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
On the show. I find this recent development kind of real disturbing, and it made me think that this isn't the first time that, a sensitive American operation like this has been compromised. It made me think of the Manhattan Project during World War II, I think that the people who heard that news at that time were probably just as
incredulous.
Yeah, as we are, people like me are hearing this now. I just wanted to make the comment that, it's not the first time the Chinese researcher in the 90s, sending plans for a nuclear device.
Yeah, of course, a lot of questions about that one, too. But, yes, these stories come out from places that you think they would never come out. And I wonder, Milt Bearden, within the intelligence community, how knit up tight is the U.S. military considered to be or not to be? I mean, we're hearing how they had to put out a kind of all-points bulletin for Arabic speakers. There's complaints about the vetting now. Is the military's internal policing and intelligence respected in that world?
For a moment. Think for a moment if we get off on a tangent here and think that we've got a group issue and we have to look at all of our native speakers of Arabic, it doesn't just affect Guantanamo. It affects NSA, for example, has got they've got a screen. I don't know how many zeros you put after the number of phone calls and intercepts per day. We simply can't function without some of the help from this crowd.
But isn't this crowd, isn't this a huge stretch, Milt, to go from these two arrests and maybe three and maybe four to saying all Arab-speaking Americans?
I fear that huge stretch. I'm saying, just like you are, that we absolutely cannot make that stretch, but I can tell you that the natural thing is when something like this happens, people circle the wagons, and these people are going to feel a little bit out. It's going to take a conscious effort on the part of the military and the rest of the communities to say, you know, let's don't go off half-cocked here.
Mm-hmm.
But I think, you know, we're not going to be able to dismiss it easily because I fear or I trust that once motivations are clear, and I don't even know what they've done, and neither does anybody
else. That's right.
It's not going to be that somebody gave him a bag of silver coin.
It's relationships. I wonder, Ted Conover, what you're thinking as you listen to all this. You and Scott Sullivan may have a disagreement on how conditions in Guantanamo do or do not stack up to Geneva Convention expectations. But I wonder if it's possible that this is an example where, you know, squeeze too hard, get too tough, and something gives. Perhaps in this case, Muslim Americans working with these prisoners.
Well, you can't rule it out, but as I've got to say, I agree so much with what Milt Bearden is saying about moving so carefully in that direction, and also that when you talk about a squeeze, maybe the kind of squeeze we're seeing is sort of two military men pushed to exhibit some humanity in a place which has not been approved by the Red Cross. They carry letters out of there. No governments except maybe Kuwait and a handful of others have said this is okay. I mean, the European Parliament is having hearings next week about Guantanamo.
But I guess that's the squeeze I mean, Ted, that if what they're witnessing is just too rough, this may be a kind of human downside where
right.
certain humans say, wait a minute, I'm going to try and intervene here.
You can't rule it out. It seems as possible as anything else.
Well, you're going to also have to understand that an interrogation that takes a year and a half, the total purpose is for bonding between interrogator and subject.
Yeah,
and we're doing this through a 24-year-old Arab American from Detroit, and if you don't think there's going to be any bonding going on there, you're not paying attention. So, you know, it's not a question of vetting them before they come into the program. I suspect it's a question of keeping tabs and every so often, you know, putting your hand on the shoulder and saying, how you doing? Is this thing getting to you at all?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Ted, can you imagine a reason for bringing out sketches of the prison, who's in what cell, the cell block, sort of blueprints?
Other than intelligence work, no, only if you came to care for them. If this had been your life for a year and now you were leaving forever and you wanted to remember who was who, I mean, that's the only thing I could imagine.
Or, as one of our callers suggested, if you were a whistleblower.
Yep.
Or if you were a spy. What an awful range of possibilities here, and we're a long way from having the final facts tonight. We're going to be very clear on that, and yet the issues raised are so disturbing that we wanted to get into them, and we thank each one of you for helping us do that. Milt Bearden, thanks very much for being with us tonight.
Thank you.
Milt Bearden is author of The Main Enemy, the inside story of the CIA's final showdown with the KGB, a 30-year veteran of the CIA. And Scott Sullivan, thanks very much for joining us from Durham, North Carolina tonight.
My pleasure, Tom.
Scott Sullivan, professor at Duke University Law School, executive director of Duke's Center on Law, Ethics, and National Security. He was a 25-year JAG lawyer for the Air Force. Ted Conover, the man who spent the time in Guantanamo, thanks very much to you for being with us tonight.
My pleasure. Thank you, Tom.
Ted Conover, writer for the New York Times Magazine. His summertime New York Times story was In the Land of Guantanamo. You can continue the story at onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.